Well, good morning, greetings, and welcome. And on behalf of the entire Dom Prep staff of over 20,000 readers and registered members worldwide, greetings and welcome to another Dom Prep executive briefing held here at the National Press Club. I'm Marty Masuk, the publisher of Dom Prep Journal, DomesticPreparedness.com, and the DPJ Weekly Brief, and I thank you all for attending. Today's briefing concludes our 2012 executive briefing series. And what a year it's been. Topics have included Seaburn training that was held here in the press club, special event planning held across town at National Ballpark, plus lively discussions on radiological preparedness conducted in Lower Manhattan, New York, and a biodetection briefing presented at Harvard University in Cambridge. Yet today's briefing is very different from the other events we've hosted. This one is the culmination of over a year's work. Over 500 professionals have contributed, and the product of that work you have now, and it's the Dom Prep Action Plan, Building Resilient Regions for a Secure and Resilient Nation. Now, before we begin our presentations, I must express sincere appreciation to many people, and a heartfelt thank you goes to my staff. Susan Collins and Kathy Feynman played a major part in producing this report. And they did it in addition to their regular duties while hitting all of Dom Prep's publishing deadlines. Also, thanks to our editor, Jim Hessman, for keeping the ship afloat while we worked on this project. And, of course, Laura Johnson, who helped with the logistics of the workshops. So first and foremost, please join me in thanking them for their brilliant work in making today's event happen. Additionally, I'd like to thank the Dom Prep 40 Advisory Board. Specifically, Bill Austin, Dennis Schrader, Paula Scalingi, Craig Vanderwagen, and Bob Steffen, who sends his regrets he can't be here today. Each provided their expertise and support to the project throughout the year. You'll be hearing their presentations later this morning. In addition to those advisors just cited, will all members of the Dom Prep 40 Advisory Board please stand, and I want to thank you all. Bill? Next, I want to thank John Morton, a true friend, colleague, and advisor for many years. John had a running start at helping compile this report, and I urge you all to read his recently published book, Next Generation Homeland Security, Network Federalism, and the Course to National Preparedness. So thank you, John, for everything you do for us. Also, please join me in thanking today's underwriters. They include Up Technology, Katie Analytical, Witt Associates, and Booz Allen Hamilton. The workshops, report, and today's briefing would not be possible without their support. In addition to their monetary contribution, which allows all of us to be here free of charge, they truly are experts at advancing preparedness. Thank you all. Also note that today's briefing is about regional resilience, more specifically, building resilient regions for a secure and resilient nation. About a year ago, select advisors from the Dom Prep 40 team met and discussed the effects that the reduced grant dollars would have on local and state authorities. Many questions were asked, and together we only guessed what the answers could be. But frankly, we didn't know. The lack of data from those hit the hardest began this project. And ladies and gentlemen, to my knowledge, this report is the first regional polling of thought from those with the responsibility to be resilient and maintain preparedness. Thanks goes to the good people at the University of Chicago, NORC, who helped review the data. Now, we chose today's date because of its closeness to the election. Little did we know that Superstorm Sandy would overshadow political events. That helps us to explain why there are a few empty chairs here today that are unoccupied. It reminds us that Dom Prep's audience, they're highly involved professionals working in operations and today are deployed, and our thoughts are with them. Now to the business at hand. It's my pleasure and honor to introduce our keynote speaker, Thad Allen, Senior Vice President, Booz Allen Hamilton. In 2006, Jim Hessman, John Morton, and I traveled to the Coast Guard headquarters to interview Admiral Allen, where he was commandant. The topic was interagency lessons learned from Katrina response, a very relevant topic for that day. But, sir, I have to apologize. It's taking us so long to get together with you once again, but we've noticed that you've been quite busy in that time frame, haven't you? Among your many other duties and responsibilities, in 2006, President Obama selected him to serve as the National Incident Commander for the Unified Response to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Today, he's leading a firm-wide effort to vision the future of homeland security and the future of resiliency and how it can be achieved, which makes him a perfect spokesperson to kick off today's discussion. Admiral, it's my pleasure to have you join us today. Sir, the podium is yours.
Thanks for the introduction, and thanks for having me here this morning. It's not often I get to sing to the choir. An audience is attuned to the topic, as you are here today. My goal this morning is not to preview the very significant issues you're going to be talking about related to regionalization, but to kind of maybe lay some framework to think about that in a larger context. We are encountering in this world much greater complexity, ambiguity, and uncertainty in our daily events and in the major crises we have to deal with than I can ever remember in my lifetime. And you can attribute a lot of things to that, and maybe we need to have a discussion, and I will briefly refer to climate change. But the fact of the matter is our lives are becoming more complex, and a lot of it has to do with the expansion of the man-built environment and its interaction with the natural environment. The more infrastructure we build, the more we have population densities, and the more that interacts, we cease to have events that are natural disasters or man-made disasters. These are actually hybrid events where there is interaction with the human-built environment and the natural environment. Because of that, there's a greater degree of complexity and interaction, and it kind of mirrors a lot of the challenges that government's facing right now. I teach a course at George Washington University called Leadership in Large Complex Organizations, and I spend the entire first class talking about complexity and the implications of complexity and the challenge we meet in trying to carry out, in this case it's public administration and public policy, but actually it's governing writ large. And you have to kind of go back to give you a little bit of a historical perspective. You know, back in the 19th century, if something occurred, you were pretty much on your own if you were a Midwest farmer or a small city. We were isolated from the rest of the world. And dealing with large natural catastrophes had a much different flavor to it. And government's role was much different then. Into the 20th century, as we started dealing with the Depression and some of the great public works in this country, we started increasing this interaction between the man-built environment and the natural environment. And we also started increasing the complexity of public programs. And I want to talk about this in a minute because it relates to your horizontal collaboration, which is a major theme you're going to be talking about here this morning. As we moved into the New Deal and World War II, we created a military-industrial base in this country. And the result of all of that moving into this century is the fact that there are very few programs in government that are actually produced by a single agency within the authority and jurisdiction of their authorizing legislation and their appropriations. And one of the reasons that is the level of complexity of our modern world and sometimes the inadequacy of the current statutes or appropriations to meet what the public generally regards as a whole of government, a whole of community, whole of nation response to what they see as a very complex problem. And they're a little bit befuddled that somehow the federal government can't get their arms around these problems. And I think we don't understand that the nature of the environment and the problem is changing. What has happened at the same time is we moved into an era of what Don Kettle, who's a professor of public administration and School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, he calls it co-production. In his book, The Next Government of the United States, he talks about if you don't have the authority, the jurisdiction, or the resources to solve a problem within the bounds of your own agency, what you end up doing is you have to cooperate and collaborate and network across boundaries to achieve those goals. And more increasingly, at least since the end of World War II, with the rise of the military-industrial base, that involves the private sector. We already know there's a relationship that exists defined in the Constitution that all power is not granted to the federal government, reserved to the states, and we know the role of state and local governments in disaster response. I think it's much less clear about how we move into one of these complex events with the existing relationships between the federal government, state and local government, and the private sector. And you can extend that to the NGO community and faith-based organizations as well. And for that reason, it puts a premium on being able to understand complexity and deal with it. That requires new leadership skills, agility and thinking, trying to deal with issues that are way beyond your legal jurisdiction, how you exert authority when you don't have any legal authority to try and make something happen, and how do you build teams and collaborate across these boundaries. For that reason, this notion of complexity, boundaries, operating across boundaries, and co-production are things we have to understand as givens in the bureaucratic ecology that we all live in relation to these responses. And we all know we live in a political and bureaucratic framework when these things happen. The second thing I think we need to understand is we will never have a large, complex event, whether it's a operating program in the federal government or a crisis that won't involve public participation. And by public participation, I define that very, very broadly. It includes a 24-hour news cycle. It includes social media. It includes volunteers, faith-based organizations. And the reason we have to take that into account is it's going to occur, and if we don't plan and understand how to deal with that, it's going to happen anyway because there's no barrier to entry. Social media. It used to be if you were conducting a public program, you would go out and do your job. There'd be some evaluation of that, and there'd be some result that everybody would be briefed on. And even in military operations, we had war correspondents but embedded with the troops. Then maybe 2 weeks later, they'd be sent a dispatch back. This is what the landing in Guadalcanal looked like. First person on scene with a cell phone that's interviewed immediately on CNN. We're in this very unique period where we're being evaluated instantaneously on the organization and performance of the response when we haven't even got all the resources on ground to start that response. And I've heard people complain about it, and I've done two very large events that are very visible, and everybody gets upset about, you know, the fact matters, you can't change it. It's like the weather, it just is. You have to factor it in and understand there will be public participation. So you have to understand how to deal with the media. You have to understand how to deal with people that are up on the internet, social media, and everybody understands this now because it's actually becoming part of response planning. It's becoming part of trying to assess what's going on. And it's happening all over the world right now. Following Twitter during these events, common practice by everybody that's involved in it. The NGO and the faith-based community, all of the volunteer organizations that are out there, they're going to show up and they're going to want to help. We have to think proactively about how we want to do that as well. This also relates regionally because I think a lot of these things are best done regionally. There's some very large volunteer organizations such as the American Red Cross that do an outstanding job at a national level in coordinating with the federal government. But the fact of the matter is to try and integrate these other entities into a response at a local level requires some work up front or it's not going to be easy. And some of you may have heard me state this before. The last thing you want when you're trying to run one of these crises is what we call an SUV, spontaneous unaffiliated volunteer. You don't have the time, disposition, or energy to deal with them, and they're there and they want to help. And when you tell them, I can't help you, what do? They go to Channel 4. Then you got another problem. I spent a lot of time after I retired, before I came to Booz Allen, working with the Points of Light Institute in VOAD and some other folks to try and talk about having a conversation with the volunteer community about certification, accreditation, the things that become problematic that don't allow you to ingest that resource, passion, and commitment and apply that to any kind of mission effect. I think that's an enduring issue, and I think that's best handled regionally as well, unless you have an overarching framework for a very large volunteer organization such as the American Red Cross. Well, what does this mean moving forward? I see the regionalization issue, and I looked at the recommendations that are going to be talked about this morning. I think they're outstanding, by the way. They make a lot of sense. There's a lot of just plain good thinking in there about how people really have to relate to each other when one of these events are occurring. So I think what we need to think about is both a horizontal and a vertical application of this regionalization or collaboration concept. At the very high federal level, we have to continue to learn how to work across departments. And despite every doctrine I've ever seen written, Homeland Security Presidential Directive 5, Title 10 for the Department of Defense, you name it, nothing is as elegant as it needs to be when one of these events happens, and there's still a collaboration and a cross-coordination that has to occur, and it gets back to this boundary issue that nobody has enough authority and jurisdiction within their authorizing legislation, their appropriations, to solve the problem by themselves. That happens at the state level. It happens at the local level. So if you think about that moving down, if you're going to focus on resiliency and the ability to get through one of these cycles from the beginning of the event until you reestablish what is the new normal or the new status afterwards, it's going to involve the ability of the community to interact and create resiliency at their level, and you can't have the impacts at the local level if you try and mandate that through national frameworks. So this notion about regional frameworks locally, horizontal coordination, is dead on. I was in this room, I think it was about 6 or 7 months ago, at another event we were doing on preparedness, and I, at the risk of boring some of you with the story again, I think it's important enough to be told again, and the story is of C.J. Huff, the superintendent of the Joplin Public Schools. He had showed up there a couple years before the tornado and put an emphasis on reducing the dropout rate in the high school, and because of that, he went out and he did outreach to the local community. And while he thought he was focusing on public education, What he did was he created a regional framework, he created pre-need relationships, and he was collaborating and coordinating toward an objective. In this case, it was to reduce the dropout rate and improve education. And when the tornado came through on the day of graduation of the high school, and they happened to be graduating across town, if they'd been in the high school, they probably lost several hundred kids. The high school was decimated. The whole town was devastated. But the whole town showed up the next day and rallied behind him because he had created those frameworks, those relationships, those trusted relationships in advance of the event. And because of that, he made payroll the next day with his teachers. And because of that, they started high school the following fall in a mall, deserted mall. And they put a football team on the field that was the subject of a special by ESPN. That is resiliency. But if you go back and you do the forensics on it and the constituent elements of why that happened, they're in your report. There's innate goodness in the recommendations that you're going to be talking about here today and the applicability at national and local levels. And it is time to have a larger conversation in the country. We in Booz Allen that work in this line of business understand that. A lot of it has to do with building social capital, which is the basis for trust that binds everybody together in these relationships. A lot of it has to do with trying to be able to assess resiliency. And we're looking at ideas about how could you even come up with an index or some way to check the vital signs of a community. And it's going to be different in every community based on the local vulnerabilities and risks that are associated with that. So as we move forward, I think there are a couple things we need to consider. Number one is, how do you scale these things? And come up with a general framework that can be used at a federal level, a local level, and a state level, knowing that they're going to be different, but the outcomes need to be the same, I think is where the discussion needs to go moving forward. The problem is we need to have a common language. As you all know, the reason we have ICS is we never had a common language for many, many years in how we do emergency response. I think there's enormous value in creating a jargon or a lexicon associated with what we're talking about. And you can see a lot of definitions of resiliency. But the fact of the matter is, and I took this question at a press conference after Katrina, I had a very, very pointed question put to me on social equity issues involved in the response. There were some issues raised about whether or not there might have been a factor about social equity in the response. And after telling them that a Coast Guard rescue swimmer hanging from the bottom of a helicopter reaching down is not looking at the color of the hand reaching up, there's a certain time and place where that doesn't even come into play. That said, events do not create the preconditions. Now, that sounds like an overwhelming statement of the obvious, but you would be surprised how many people do not understand that in relation to resiliency. The event does not create the preconditions. To the extent that preconditions exist, they are exacerbated by the event. So Alan's shorthand version of talking to folks locally about resiliency, in my view, is the equivalent of the human immune system. The measure of resiliency, in my view, is the ecological, sociological equivalent of an immune system. And when somebody with a low immune system gets sick, there are greater consequences associated with that. If you have higher density of population, you have higher populations of aging people, you have issues about high-rise buildings and transportation. Those are all preconditions that will exacerbate the effects of the event. I think sometimes we can get too technical in talking about the threat and the risk and, you know, how high is the water going to rise and why is the water rising and get involved in science over climate change and things like that. But the real issue is, how resilient are we as a community and how effective is our immune system? How have we inoculated ourselves as a society through social capital, pre-need relationships, horizontal collaboration and frameworks that actually enable us to withstand these events? And in my view, that is the ultimate measure of resiliency. It is the sociological equivalent of the human immune system.
Well, good morning, and thank you to special thank you to Martin for allowing me to be involved in this and all the effort that Domestic Preparedness Magazine has put into this process. I really wanted to talk about what we've done for the last year. And, you know, along this journey, we've discovered, for example, that there's a lot of resiliency efforts that you will hear explained, that you will hear documented in our report, for example. What happens in this process as we go through the assemblage of the information is a discovery, in fact, a very blunt discovery, that half the urban area security initiative areas of the United States were recently defunded in the process. So having said that, let me tell you what we found basically as we went through this process. We found a lot of raw data that shows that people are doing it right, that they understand resiliency, We found a lot of people who had pride in what they were doing. They had a determination to maintain the capability to do the things that they do. We found this in people. We found it in programs. We found it in whole institutions, a difference now than what you might have expected just a few years ago. We also found a terrific amount of leadership. We would learn later on that when we went to Harvard that it's really about meta-leadership. And I'm very proud to say this morning I had the opportunity to meet one of the prime examples of meta-leadership in Admiral Allen, and thank you for that. We also found some confusion. We also found some people who were really disappointed in this process, and we found some people who were really bewildered. And that's really because when you look around and pay attention to what resiliency really is, it's anybody's definition. But we know for a fact, because we've been told for 11 years now, that we have what's called common sovereignty over this whole process. As you've already heard explained, this is not a process. This is not a concept that can take place just because somebody dictated it from D.C. or somebody dictated it from the state capitol or whatever. The resiliency we found as we crossed the nation in various ways was that it's a state of mind. It's also a feeling of confidence, and it's also a level of training that's taking place across this nation. It's an expectation of preparedness. At the same time, it's a type of response, and it's a motivator for recovery. It's also, once again, a huge demonstration of various types of leadership. So what is my message today? My message today really is that if you take a look at what's happening right now, Hurricane Sandy, but you will discover if you watch very closely with Hurricane Sandy, as you have watched for the last several weeks, we are going to discover, as we are discovering right now, that a lot of things are going right. Yet there are going to be some pundits who will show us before it's all over what didn't go so well. But if nothing else, it is showing us that there is a very solid capability when it comes to resilience. There are people performing functions not only to save their own property, not only to save their own lives and their own families, but there are teams of people that didn't even exist 10 years ago. You don't have to look very far to find the local community emergency response team. You don't have to look very far to find that there's some form of search and rescue team involved. There's always some form of activity, whether it's faith-based, whether it's community-oriented. You know, sometimes we recruit whole groups of people, like the Kiwanis Club or a local church, to be a CERT team in the process. We found that to be a very effective way of recruiting. But along with that, there's a system that's been evolving in this country for the last 5 to 10 years, and it's the incident management team process that's getting a real workout right now in the states of New York and New Jersey. This process has been evolving. It was coming to light when Hurricane Katrina hit. Back in those days, I can remember that people had to compete with each other to get to go. Now, before this is over, they will be crying for people to come and fill in, backfill, and that sort of thing, because we don't have enough of that capability to really make this work. Plans are in place to make more teams to make that kind of thing work. But my message is resiliency is there. It's live and well. It's well and alive, however way you want to say this. I will tell you that before this whole process started, another statement of the obvious is that the local governments and the state governments, they didn't spend any money on Homeland Security prior to 9/11. That's pretty obvious. Well, throughout the entire period of the last 10 years or so, they've spent a great deal of your money, a great deal of federal money, $34+ billion, and that's probably not even counting all the associated costs that go with this. But there's another very obvious thing that's getting ready to happen, and that is that when the funding is cut, the local government and the state government don't have the money to pay that. You know, everyone in this room understands the economic situation that we're in. And, you know, this process is going to have a real roadblock at this point. Local governments are not going to obviously put the money in this. So our journey hasn't really been over the last 10 years. Our journey is really just now beginning. And in this process, what we've got to do is figure out, that this is not some kind of finished government program. This is not the interstate highway or the bridge that spend money on, and when it's over, we cut the ribbon and everybody goes home and they're happy. You know, this may, in fact, turn out to be our bridge to nowhere before this is over, but the real content here is that this is very much like how we defend ourselves from a national defense standpoint. Having been involved in that process for years, there was always a combination of factors going on that included the federal government, obviously the Department of Defense that I was involved with, and local governments involved with their National Guard programs. That program's still in place today. It allows a rapid expansion of our combat forces whenever those types of things are needed, so that everybody has a very clear understanding of how that works. Now, if you think back, or at least look back from a historical standpoint, a couple of hundred years ago, it didn't exist that way. There were a lot of militias that came together, supported the issue, and they all went home, took their weapon and their horse, and went on. You know, and we learned over a long period of time that what we really needed was a very systematic process that allowed each of the governors to have their own army, each of the governors to have their own kind of process, and that we support that as it goes along. I would venture to tell you that we've started that program in the last 10 or 12 years in Homeland Security. We have started a process that has built up a great deal of resiliency. We have been on that journey for the last 10 years or so. I'm also here to tell you some bad news. Not that it'll happen today, maybe not even next week or next year, but common sense would tell you that when you take a program and defund it, and it's such a vital program to the safety and security of everybody in the community, that in a period of about 3 years from now, it'll be a little weaker. In a period of about 5 to 7 years, when all the guys with white hair like me start retiring, it'll be even weaker. And 10 years down the road, we'll be throwing stuff away like we did back in the old civil defense days when you went down in the base of the city hall and collected all that junk that had just sit there and deteriorated and threw it out, okay? And then we're on to something else. My point here is, you know, that we have a system that's built on resiliency and the concepts of whole community. But we've decided at some level of the federal government that about half of America doesn't fall into that program. I don't know whether that's right or wrong. I don't know whether it's based on a lot of analytical analysis, but I know that it's having an impact on the people that have to do this in the street, such as myself. There is a real question in a lot of people's minds about how come this particular place can be designated as we're going to make sure they're safe, but some other community may not be designated that way. You know, America's resiliency will be based on, first of all, belief in the mission. And we have all believed this for the last 10 years. It'll be based on political support. We know that political support is starting to fade away. We don't want to be another one of those federal government programs that once it wore out the novelty and the, whatever you want to call it, the sexiness about it, that suddenly nobody cares much about it anymore. We know that it'll be built on solid leadership. We also know that some level of federal funding's got to be involved in this process. And we also know that if the concept of Homeland Security Protection, if that very vague concept that any speaker would get up and describe, based on any definition you want to use, if that's going to be successful, as the Admiral pointed out, it's got to involve every American in this country. It's got to, it can't be a system of winners and losers before this process is over, because it will have a devastating effect on our capabilities somewhere down the road. You know, I'm much older than a lot of people in this room, but I can tell you that from a historical perspective, we've always had, as Americans, we've always had, seems to me in my entire lifetime, this method of instantaneous gratification. We solve a problem, we move on to something else. And, you know, it didn't take the Vietnamese long to figure out that if they waited long enough, we'd get tired and we'd go home. It didn't take the Afghanis long enough, very long to figure that out, or any other place we've ever been. But this is not one of those things that we can give up on and decide that we're going to have a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So along the way, as I mentioned, our journey is just beginning. And, you know, at the local level, granted, I don't necessarily have the viewpoints that you'll hear in a lot of this discussion, but I can tell you that where the rubber meets the road is how this thing really works. And it works in a combination of individuals doing their deal, organizations doing their process, local governments, state governments, federal governments, and we didn't even mention regionalization. We spent the last 10 years, every grant the federal government ever put out had a requirement. It had to be supportive of regionalization, only to discover that the majority of the states were only forced to do that so they could get the block check to get the grant money. Okay? Now, I'm being very candid, but the reason I'm doing that is because this is a significant concern. Are we now going to float back to the process where if you're not one of the lucky chosen few municipalities, that this is going to lead us back somewhere down the road about 10 years from now where we get another surprise and discover that we've made another very colossal mistake? The bottom line that I wanted to bring to you today was, let's not waste $34 billion. If we weren't going to stay the battle, if we weren't going to stay on a battlefield till this was over, then Well, why were we here to start with? You hear this all the time in national politics. You hear it in foreign policy and everything else. And we're doing the same thing right here in our country, at least from my viewpoint. All I'm saying is, let's stay the battle. It doesn't cost what you might think it might cost, and probably a lot less than what's already being spent. But we do have to have sustainability in every community that's developed that kind of capability, or someday we'll all be retired watching somebody else learn all these lessons over again. Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Dennis Schrader, and I got to say it's a pleasure working with Bill Austin. Bill's a pretty plain-spoken guy and tells it like it is, and I've really enjoyed working with him this past year on this. I'm going to cover a couple of findings 4 and 5, which deal with public-private preparedness collaborations and professional development. Just a couple of thoughts. From my observation of going through this process, it's clear that after 10 years of federal grants and the adoption of NIMS, that we've stimulated the development of collaborative models throughout the nation. And you'll see in the appendix there's a map that shows some of those collaborations. However, from the data, what is less clear is whether these models, one, are embraced, two, are understood, or three, are valued by the various public safety and public health agencies that are intended to support. So I think that's a key takeaway from this whole process. And again, I'm giving you my interpretation of what I believe is in the report. The second takeaway from the report, it's also not clear that the capabilities that have been built to date with this $34 billion that Bill mentioned will survive without leadership commitment. And I've been excited over the last 3 or 4 years about this whole idea of the whole of community. Regional collaboration, if you recall, was one of the 7 priorities. When I was in Maryland leading our program there, it was one of the 7 original priorities for grants, and we really embraced that. To my horror, what I've really found out is that, as Bill said, in some cases, it was just a check the box. But so there are a number of people around this country that have really taken this seriously. But the question is, if whole of community is a great idea, it's tied directly to the work we're talking about here around regional collaboration. But the question is it going to become a cultural norm through the development of the next generation of homeland security leaders? And I think that's an open question, quite frankly. And I think the other observation is I think there's significant anecdotal evidence that suggests that more rigorous study is needed to draw conclusions, which is why it was important we had NORC at the University of Chicago take a look at this report. And as Marty has often said, these surveys we've done are not necessarily statistically valid, but they're a lot better than just somebody's anecdotal opinion. And what we've come to realize is that with all the expert input into this process, there is some baseline inference you can draw from the qualitative analysis. But what really needs to happen is there needs to be much more quantitative study of these issues in the future to draw hard conclusions. And then finally, this study provides some clues for the follow-on analysis and research. So hopefully this study will be picked up by folks. I know Dom Prep gets thousands of downloads on the information. So even though we may have a small group here today, there'll probably be 10 or 15,000 downloads of this report. So it's going to go out all around the country, and that's the real value of this work. Now, let me also mention some of the diagnostic questions that were embedded within the thought process as we went out and collected the data. The first question that I had as I was looking at this is, have we created enough value that it's in our interest to pursue regional investment in the capabilities that have been developed? Now, what does that mean? What does that mean? That means if we've received 50, 100, or 150 million in a particular region over a period of 10 years, were the capabilities that were developed, which were supposed to be sustainable, that was one of the criteria, were those capabilities developed, are they of value to sustain, or was it just a matter of, well, we got the grant money because we need to demonstrate that we got the grant money and we spent it and, you know, we're going to move on, as Bill so eloquently said earlier. That's a key question, and we were trying to explore that as we went around the country. Secondly, is there enough leadership knowledge of intergovernmental options to create networks? For example, I'm astonished oftentimes. In Maryland, when we put our fusion center together, we used the ATAC, Anti-Terrorism Advisory Council framework, which brought everybody together in an umbrella, working with the various federal agencies, state and local agencies, and the U.S. Attorney's Office. And when you talk to people, and our theory at the time was that's a sustainable model because we knew the grant money was going away, so we put our fusion center in an FBI space where they paid for the rent, they paid for the equipment, they paid for the clearances, because we knew that the money was going to go away. Well, now, all of a sudden, 10 years later, there's this huge surprise that the money's going away, and oh my God, we built this $100 million operation we can't sustain. And I sit there and just look at people when they say those kind of things, and I say, really? Really? So I think that's one of the questions out there, is there enough leadership understanding of intergovernmental options to create networks? And I think in this fiscal environment, people should be demanding that, and they will be demanding it, if not necessarily in this context, just the fact that their expectations are high, but the resources are diminished. Next question, is there currently enough public-private collaboration to build on for the future? Has this concept taken root so that we can build on it now when we really need it? And I'm going to mention in a second some of the organizations that are out there that maybe that's a possibility, but I think it's unclear. And then finally, if these networks exist, can they be sustained, and how do you operationalize these concepts? Now, just a couple of thoughts. I would also argue that when we're talking about the private sector, if you look at coordinating public and private sector resilience, there's a responsibility in both sides of that equation, both the private sector and the public sector, to learn each other's language. Now, let me give you two examples. In the private sector, the language of business continuity that discusses supply chain, revenue disruption, workforce protection, those are the things that drive the private sector. And you have to deal with people like the CFOs and those sorts of folks in organizations. In the public sector, as we're organized around NIMS, there has to be an understanding by the private sector of and respect for the public sector language and priorities. I've been working with the American Society of Civil Engineers, for example, and there's been an initiative there to get engineers to have a resource type, and we've worked with Craig Fugate on this to get that into the pipeline. And originally, some of the engineers were complaining, well, why can't we just show up, sort of this SUV concept that the Admiral was talking about. Why can't we just show up? We're engineers. We should just be able to come to the scene, and they're going to embrace us. Well, we had to kind of get people to understand that's not really the way it works. Both sides of the equation need to begin to respect each other's culture. And this is when I talk about growing this generation of leaders, we need people to be going through various assignments, state and local, federal, private sector assignments, so that as people rise into the leadership ranks, I envision leaders in the Homeland Security Emergency Management environment 25 years from now will have these varied assignments in their background if they're going to be considered for senior leadership, and they ought to be mentoring their juniors in that same regard. One of the things that I found very interesting when we were in Indianapolis, Bob Steffen, who's not with us today, U.S. Steel had a major initiative in Indiana. I thought that was very interesting. And in the book, we refer to these low-cost networks that have developed. And Paul Escalingi has been involved, for example, in the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. We've got the Infrastructure Security Partnership. I've been very active in the Mid-Atlantic in the All Hazards Consortium. And I'll give you an example of why this even just recently with Sandy. Within the consortium, we've developed these partnerships with say, for example, Hughes Satellite. When they couldn't figure out where all the gas stations were closed and the pharmacies, we got the data from Hughes. They put it in a spreadsheet for us, and we were able to tell the people on the ground, and people were just astonished by this, as to where who was up and who was down at a gas station, at a pharmacy, at a hotel. Very simple things that the private sector can produce instantaneously and pass if you've got that pre-wired. And that, the consortium's done that. We also got a call from the American Bakers Association. They wanted to deliver their bread, and they couldn't get to the people because they had priority for fuel, but the people on the ground didn't know they had priority for fuel. So they called the consortium. We knew the right people to call, and we made that happen. That didn't just happen. That's been 7 or 8 years worth of work building those trusted relationships. But again, I'm not so sure that with these kinds of organizations, you've got Mesh in the Midwest, you've got the Bay Area group that Paul is involved in, InfraGuard, Nedrix in the Northeast. How valued are these organizations and structures, or is it just seen as something that needs to be tolerated within the public safety, public health community in the government? And on the other side of the coin, how much does the private sector really see it as value for their business continuity purposes? These questions need to be explored at a much deeper level. We scratched the surface. I think, and you'll see from the data, it's not well understood, and you can't draw conclusions from the data yet. But there are some indications that these are issues. The last thing I'll mention as we look at multi-jurisdictional preparedness, and I would commend John's book to you. John's got just released his book on New Generation Homeland Security. If we're going to deal with the issues that were mentioned by Bill, I think we have to have a whole new way of thinking about this, because the fact of the matter is, if you think about pre-9/11, none Luger Domenici, we were investing about $100 million or thereabouts, small amounts of money, getting a lot of value out of that, then all of a sudden we throw $34 billion at this, and the question is always, how do we measure our outcomes? And we knew the money was going to go down. The question is, how do we continue to keep this going, and what's the floor? What's the right level of investment, and who should be paying? So anyway, those are some of the thoughts that were behind the data and the collection.
Good morning, everybody. Marco Born. Pleasure to be here this morning. As the report and the study was done and the surveys were done and the meetings, one of the things that became very evident in the process was the understanding of how policy affects activity, or in some cases, the lack of policy also has an effect on activity at the federal, state, and local level. Policy in and of itself, to many, is a dry subject. Having been an old policy person myself, I know how that can be. But simply put, getting the policy right allows for a tremendous amount of creativity in execution and delivery on the notion of the policy. We have a policy about preparedness in the nation. Presidential Directive Decision 8, its predecessor, HSPD 8, all talked about an evolution of the policy around preparedness. And in PPD8's specific lexicon, the word resiliency began to take on an even more defined context. I think one of the things we discovered along the way is that national policy, or in the cases of presidential directive policies, while their scope seems broad because of the office that is emanating it, their practical effect tends to diminish as you move outside the sphere of the executive branch. Because by nature, these are only legal documents for the executive agencies under the control of the president and have no binding effect on state and local government, quite frankly, have no binding on the Congress, certainly have no binding on others and individuals at the local level unless they see within that policy framework a value, and a value that can be adopted at those various levels to achieve a national purpose. And as we looked at the results of the sessions, there were some things that became very evident, and that is the policy in and of itself is not the wrong policy. The notion of resiliency, the notion of preparedness, is something that is embraced at all levels of government and, quite frankly, understood, at least on a surface level, by the public writ large. They understand preparedness and resiliency is when something bad happens, I know that somebody will be coming to help me. Or if I take some steps on my own to be a little more self-reliant, I'll be less reliant on others to come rescue me. The nation certainly has moved in varied directions on this topic for a long time. You know, in Presidential Directive Decision 8, put into words the notions of whole community, whole of government. And those actually are very different things in a way. Whole of government is a construct where if you really understand the words, it means all of the government working in unison. Not necessarily those beyond government. Whole of community is meant to be broader. It's meant to be a much more elaborate construct of thought to involve all levels of government, but at the same time, private sector, NGOs, industry writ large, and other groups. And we'll talk a little bit about how this really manifests itself on the ground, especially when it comes to the bottom-up activities that are taking place all across the country. That initiative about whole of community and community resilience building came to light in some of the discussions at the local level. You know, there was a number of sessions where they talked about local sustainability models, the notion that the policy of resilience at a local level is really about trying to empower folks in that local community to take the steps that are within their sphere of influence to improve and to partner. And those networks are not necessarily dictated or structured by government. They happen in some cases to be ad hoc. Sometimes the government is the convener, sometimes the government is the advocator. And as a result, you don't get regions in the sense of defined geographical areas that are border-centric. You'll find that the borders tend to ebb and flow. The involvement tends to go beyond, say, the federal regional model, which is, you know, cutting off states like Connecticut from New York. Well, we know the reality of Connecticut and New York is they're inexplicably intertwined, or New Jersey and Delaware, or Pennsylvania, Maryland. Those kind of artificial constructs based on geographical borders tend to be blurred when it comes to true regionalization activity. You can't say that the urban area security of Philadelphia region is a single state or a single FEMA region kind of entity. It encompasses New Jersey and Delaware and Maryland as well. And so many of the respondents talked about the fact that it's also sub-state regional. It's not just the construct, say, in Pennsylvania where there are 9 regional task forces, but it could be within that state there are subgroups. There are core areas of activity that take place at a sub-state level. And in many cases, many of the respondents talked about the fact that that local regional thread, that fabric at that local level, has far more ability and authority to advocate on behalf of their community, to build networks on behalf of their community, and that they actually achieve their capabilities at a much greater rate. And in almost every session, folks talked about at that regional, that local regional level, the need to decentralize the data that's available to them. In other words, it's aggregated centrally, but make it available broader. Get it out to the folks that actually are doing the work on the ground that are facing those severe budget constraints. The survey also happened to show that the regions across the nation are making a concerted effort to build on existing capabilities, but a large number of them were unsure whether their region was really attempting to build on those existing capabilities with a strong notion towards roles, responsibilities, and collaborative efforts across regions. A firefighter in the Mid-Atlantic area happened to talk about strong subregions and strong collaborative environments within the area in which that individual lived. But if you're just sitting on just the outside of that network, how do you get to play? How do you get involved with it? And so as a policy construct, one of the things that becomes apparent is that the inclusiveness of being able to join that network, understanding where those networks are, and government being fostering the inclusion of all that can be involved in that network. Thad mentioned earlier a notion which sounds almost intuitive, but in a way it's not really widely understood yet, but it's becoming very apparent, and it's the notion of social capital. He talked about the networks that develop locally. Many times in this country, when it comes to a community action activity, the policy may be we want to do good things to improve our community policing or our community development process or our outreach to children in need or at risk or our schools. And as these notions of policy get developed and implemented, very rarely is it the government that actually is driving necessarily that policy construct. They may do it through official means, but they're essentially networks that get created almost on their own. And leaders emerge, and leaders emerge from unlikely areas. And because those leaders are known, because they happen to be active in major civic groups, or they happen to be somebody who is engaged in community activities and becomes widely known as a trusted advisor, a trusted leader, they take that policy and they actually start to make it real by building networks that are really based on dimensions of trust and reciprocity and networks and the collective whole within that community. And usually that is what facilitates actually gains across those communities in building resiliency in this case. The survey question respondents also were given an opportunity to answer that they weren't really sure what was happening. Because part of it is, how do you understand as a nation where the good things are happening and where they're not? How do folks at a local level really understand what groups are actually moving forward on this notion of resiliency and preparedness? And how do they get involved? And one of the things that the respondents started to talk about was that there be an imperative that government, through its own policy, whether it's national level policy or, more importantly, the policy that is driven at the state and local level, fosters that engagement, fosters the involvement, doesn't have to direct it and control it. It needs to be the advocate for it. It needs to be the convener or provide a mechanism to convene those folks, to identify those practices that are out there, export them through knowledge sharing as opposed to necessarily controlling every aspect of how they function. And that becomes the much more effective method to build community resilience. Because community resilience in many ways can only be built based on the trust that the community wants to be resilient, and that they trust the mechanisms around them that are helping them do that, and that they have a role in that environment. So from a policy perspective, what are we doing at the federal, state, and local level to help foster this? PBDA provides a national notion of this. But that's all it really provides, because it has to actually live at the state and local level, where the policy also needs to be articulated that matters to the region and the communities that are directly affected that they are supporting. So when we ask our city councils, when we ask our councils of government, when we ask our regional structures about what their notion of that policy construct needs to be, they need to adopt and clearly articulate what is the goal. Is the goal just to make sure that we have the most up-to-date fire equipment and law enforcement capability? No, it's probably broader than that. That's part of it. That's part of what makes a community resilient. But are we also fostering the networks that support the displacement of individuals, whether that be through evacuation or through disasters destroying their homes? Do we have the community resilience networks that can get our children back into the schools quickly, like in Joplin, where the school became that ad hoc network that built resilience in that community? Those are the kind of things that are what the respondents seem to be saying is important to them. And the notion of social capital around that is really kind of interesting, because a lot of the work has been done by, and a lot of the writing has been done by Robert Putnam up at the J.F. Kennedy School of Government in Harvard. And really talking about the fact that while this notion has been around since the 70s, and there was a lot of studies done in the 90s, is actually reemerging without it being completely recognized by these groups that form. When the Strategic Foresight Initiative was done in FEMA just a couple of years ago, they found communities across the country where this was happening. And we talk about identifying those bright stars. Those are the ones that need to be understood, not put on a website somewhere where they get looked at maybe and somebody might say, oh, yeah, I might adopt that. But the idea is, what's making it work? How can government understand how it's working and provide the policy mechanism and then, as necessary, the support to make it implementable at a broader community level or in communities that have not yet found their way? That's the policy challenge. And certainly moving forward, as PBD8 rolls out and the frameworks begin to be shared, you know, the understanding is the frameworks lay kind of a cornerstone of activity, but that the real activity needs to be embraced by that state and local level, not governmental necessarily, although that's important, but with the groups that will actually encourage and make that happen.
I've been looking forward to this meeting for the entire year as we have held our workshops, done the survey, and collected the information. And in putting together my remarks, I wanted to build upon what I knew was some really cogent comments from my fellow teammates on the Resilience Initiative. And what I'd like to say is, folks, after 15 years of focusing on this work, we have met the enemy, and he is us. Some of you may remember that profound statement. It's from a line in a beloved comic strip, Pogo. Some of you are probably old enough, like I am, to remember when that strip came out. The focus of this strip 40 years ago was on the environment, and that man was polluting the environment, and hey, we need to clean up our act. But today, if you look at resilience, those same words certainly apply. And if you look at large-scale disasters like Hurricane Sandy, and we've had our share of them in the last decade, yes, we're doing some things right, but we know there are so many gaps. There are so many things that we need to improve. And that's what we need to talk about today, and how we, what I call, operationalize. And some folks are already using that terminology, resilience. 14 months ago, I stood at this very same podium at the Dom Prep executive brief that was looking at the retrospective from the decade after 9/11. And I reflected at the time on how this nation had moved from pouring massive amounts of money into security to just start to focus on disaster resilience. And I noted that some good progress had been made, but so much more needed to be accomplished. The areas that myself and my fellow speakers at that event flagged as particularly important included getting a much better understanding on those interdependencies among critical infrastructures, other key providers of goods and services that would be a major factor in a disaster causing widespread cascading impacts that could retard recovery for years. What are we seeing again? Very little progress made. Over this past year, DOMPREP has dug deeper into the future of resilience, assessing where we need to go with this workshop series. And the initiative has validated many of the lessons learned that we've seen from past disasters in the United States and elsewhere. These lessons include, and I know I'm preaching to the choir, the need for expanded public-private sector collaboration, information sharing, better appreciation of the all-hazards risks that we are facing in our increasingly, as Thad said, complex, interconnected communities and the infrastructures that support those communities. These lessons learned also highlight the need, as Dennis was saying, for new ways of thinking, of organizing regionally to improve resilience, and for political and business leaders to provide the impetus and resources necessary in a tight budget environment to build a resilient nation from the grassroots up and horizontally, as we have heard this morning. And on a really heartening note, as several people have mentioned, and I would like to commend FEMA, thank heavens, a few years back for embracing whole of community, because what that has done is it has created a broad consensus across this country, particularly with the emergency management community at the local and state level, that resilience is a good thing and bringing together the whole community is a good thing. And we need to work together, and we know this needs to be done. If we're going to deal with Mother Nature, technological disasters, and if you're looking at increasingly sophisticated terrorist attacks, Think of what we're doing with drones and what drones can deliver on us. That frightens me to death just to think about it. At the same time, as one of my panelists in the Western, the coastal workshop that we did as part of the series said, as a senior executive in Kaiser Permanente, he said all the talk on resilience reminded him of the movie Groundhog Day. That really resonated. You know, where Bill Murray's character repeats the same February the 2nd over and over and over again until he finally gets it right. Then he moves on with his life. That's a good life. While there is continual talk about the importance of resilience infrastructures and communities, there has been so little focus on how do we operationalize this? And we've heard this morning that, yes, we have policy directives. We have national framework for recovery, for response, now coming out for mitigation. It's very high level. The how-to is missing. Hurricane Sandy has reinforced virtually all these lessons learned yet again from the mind-boggling physical damage and destruction to housing, businesses, infrastructure, extended power and other infrastructure disruptions, tens of thousands of people displaced, put into temporary housing that in many cases we can't find, and most recently contamination from hazardous materials, the Superfund site, and other environmental damage, huge economic losses, the list goes on. We've seen it before. So we pretty much know what the resilience gaps are. And in terms of specifically what to do, the Infrastructure Security Partnership, Don Prepinit's study, the American Society of Civil Engineers, a host of academic organizations, professional associations have documented, have mapped out these needs and what we need to do. Tackling these resilience shortfalls, though, is highly challenging, as we've also discussed this morning, because it requires regional collaboration among all levels of government. Now, I remember Bob Steffen telling me about 6 or 7 years ago when we first talked about resilience. He said, Paula, it's so hard to get our arms around this. He's absolutely right. It is. So, obviously, we need to have that collaboration, cross-sector, multi-jurisdiction, cross-function, and we need to have flexible and dynamic leadership and resources. We know this. So what at this point do we do? Well, I see that we have a golden opportunity because we have a new administration. It's a continuation of the Obama administration. We have a new Congress, and we have Hurricane Sandy. And what I can see now is at the federal level, there is interest in identifying the how-to, how we operationalize. And it's up to us to help with concrete recommendations of activities that can be undertaken. And more than that, it's what I call incorporating these activities into a roadmap for resilience. That's really what we need to have. And I'd like to, as I finalize here, toss out, and I have a whole host, believe me, of those specific activities, but a handful of the major ones that I see we could undertake right away, and there are certain federal agencies, and I basically am putting the finger on the federal agencies, and why? I work with the regions, okay? Those folks, they want to move forward. They want to be more resilient. They need guidance. They need specific what activities they need to take. They need help identifying what those are. And they need seed money and resources. You can't simply say, as a lot of the federal agencies are doing now, you need to be resilient. Go forth and be resilient. Hey, they need help. And that help has to come top down, not the direction, the seed money and the resources. And then the direction will come bottom up. So it's top down and bottom up. So what are some of these activities? First, at the national level, FEMA and federal partners should expand the focus beyond community resilience to regional resilience. And why? Because if you look at Hurricane Sandy, that's what we're worried about, are those regional impacts, the devastating mega disasters. Simply telling people that they have to be prepared for 72 hours and rely on their neighbors is not going to help them if the region that they are living in is decimated, right? Resilient communities are only as resilient as the regions in which they are located. So that's a job for FEMA, looking beyond community resilience now to regional resilience. Looking at Hurricane Sandy, other disasters, it's interdependencies. And I have to put it this way, it's like we used to say, is the economy stupid? No. For disaster resilience, it's interdependencies stupid. We have experts who have been developing models and analytic tools looking at interdependencies for the last 17 years. I know that because I was involved in some of that within the government. We need to get those tools usable for state and local folks and into their hands so they can use them for response and recovery. Third, regional resilience, we know, requires cross-sector, multi-jurisdiction information sharing and collaboration. This is absolutely essential if you're going to comprehensively address resilience, which is protection, prevention, preparedness, mitigation, response, recovery, and it's the whole nine yards. This means establishing or enhancing those existing public-private partnerships. And what I'd like to see FEMA provide grants across the country, and by the way, DOE did this for energy resilience with stimulus dollars, amazingly effective, provide grants for regions and localities to set up public-private partnerships or enhance them if they have them. That would be a small investment worth its weight in gold. Resources. We know funding and expertise is necessary to move forward. And a note of realism here. Industry and local businesses are not going to provide those resources. They're in the business to make money. However, if they see the federal government or state government providing those resources, making the investment, then they will contribute. And also if they see value added, Forbes was mentioned this morning, business continuity. A couple of more major areas here. A major area of investment is going to be pre- and post-disaster mitigation. There are a number of us focusing on that. If you're looking at aging and deteriorating infrastructure in any sort of event or disaster, those create huge vulnerabilities. These are big ticket items, okay? Resilient infrastructure assets and systems are essential for regional resilience. You can't have one without the other, as we can see from Hurricane Sandy. What this means is reinvigorating and expanding FEMA's mitigation role. It used to be fairly robust and growing. It is withered. That needs to grow. And they can work together in conjunction with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and other agencies. Lastly, there has been a lot of discussion recently on the need for new enhanced regional governance structures to resource and build disaster resilience. And Dennis, using your statement, this is a difficult nut to crack. I can tell you there is tremendous pushback in different parts of the country to move beyond what the system we've had since the beginning, and that is states and local government. And the money comes down from the federal government through the states to the localities. In some parts of the country, there are regional constructs, mechanisms that can be used. We need to identify what those are and look at them to see if they are good models for different parts of the country, and then let the localities decide themselves how they wish to customize and adopt these. One last need at the last moment decided to add here that is so important, it was mentioned this morning, situational awareness, developing a common operating picture. I can tell you that the localities, the regions are floundering with this. They're little bits and pieces, silos of excellence in different places. DHS S&T has a component that focuses on that. It's the disaster response component in S&T. They have done a little bit of work in this area. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we actually developed again a model, a construct, that could be adopted and customized to different regions in the country? So these are only a handful of concrete ideas that certain federal agencies might take ownership of. You can think of so many more, but what we need to do is jumpstart operationalizing resilience. That overall goal, as I mentioned earlier, should be to develop a comprehensive roadmap to resilience that lays out the how to enable our infrastructures, community, and regions to begin building the capabilities and capacities they need to withstand future mega disasters and also the lesser disasters as well.
Today I was going to reflect a little bit on the experience of facilitating the discussions that we had with these folks, and what does the facilitation process reveal, not so much about the cognitive elements that come through in the report and data, but the sense of where people are and what that might offer us in terms of insight. Because I think the issue here is about leadership, ultimately. There are operational and tactical concerns and requirements that lie there and need effort and work. And there is a strategic statement, whether it's PDD-8 or other statements of that nature, that sort of help to articulate strategy in a broader sense. But if we expect to see regional activity develop as a real issue, there has to be clear leadership in this process. And as I was thinking about what is facilitation about, it made me think about, this is what I tried to do in the ASPR role. It's what I tried to do in Indian Health Service. Okay, I'm a public health doc, have all those credentials, all the baggage that goes with it too, of course. But in Indian Health, for instance, I had 572 tribes to contend with, each of whom felt as though their political and social reality was unique and needed to be dealt with in a unique and isolated sort of way. But if we were to make progress in elevating the health of American Indians and Alaska Natives, to make the economies of scale work, we had to work with a common effort. And what that required for me to do was to help them understand that there were best practices available to them, that yes, they were unique. Yes, they had cultural hegemony in their environment. But indeed, there were some best practices that they could incorporate into their environment and achieve what they hoped for their people just as much as I hoped it, and that was to improve their health. Again, in Iraq, the similar circumstance of trying to work with a Ministry of Health that for decades had been driven by the need to survive within an oppressive political environment. And suddenly that oppression was lifted, and these staff wondered then how would they exercise what they had been trained to do, but had set aside in some large measure in order to survive within an oppressive bureaucracy. And it was building their sense of self-worth and their sense of solidity that had to be facilitated, because they were going to have to do the work. They were going to have to make the change. They were going to have to articulate that future, not a bunch of Americans sitting in their ministry. So how to facilitate their sense of capability, that there was a future that they could contribute to in a significant way, and that it was in their hands to develop that. Thad talked a little bit about some events in Katrina, and as he was telling the story about the dogs, Stephanie Ostrowski, who's one of my fellow officers, comes to mind, and Stephanie, of course, came to help, brought her horse with her. And we brought many of those animal rescue people into the ESF-8, listened to their concerns, inquired as to their focus, and then tried to frame a means for them to contribute in a coherent and effective way that worked with the process rather than in spite of or in conflict with the process. This was about leadership, embracing that activity and bringing it together with others to focus on what our common problem is. Helping individuals with their passion for a particular mission and a strategy to bring that to bear in a collective environment. So as I was facilitating in Hartford and Indianapolis and so on, it struck me that this was a similar challenge to what the feds had. And in fact, in Hartford, of course, it started with, why the hell aren't the FEMA people here? They should be doing this. Why aren't they working with us, convening this and facilitating it? Calm down. The answer is with you, here. Yes, FEMA can be part of that picture, and in fact, as a matter of policy, going back to Dave Pollison, yet another Florida Democrat paramedic rescue guy, FEMA has moved increasingly towards the notion of empowering, strengthening, reinforcing local and regional activity. So when there was a call for focusing the grants on this, well, in fact, the 2013 grant policy for FEMA is targeting more regional development. How to make it real and not just a bureaucratic exercise is about the intellectual honesty of the people in those regions, but that can be led and facilitated through engagement in those regional discussions, listening, inquiring, and framing how this can work, bringing in best practices, as Paula has talked about and others here today. Region 4 has a marvelous best practice vis-a-vis understanding who all the responders may be. In fact, they share those personnel databases, volunteers as well as more formal workers, across that region. They've done a marvelous job of developing a regional approach to patient evacuation, and along the way helped us at HHS to figure that out a little bit so we could teach our folks how to do this working more effectively with state and local people. This is a best practice. But without engagement at that regional level to facilitate their dialogue and discussion and appropriately framing where those best practices may occur, it's only a bureaucratic exercise. Policy is stated, but policy's not carried through. This is leadership. Federal government, we have a tendency to be much more invested in managing. Everybody has to be a good manager, look at your performance game, blah, 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 blah. And we forget that it's about leadership, ultimately. So, in facilitating, I heard that frustration with the feds. I heard the fear about the waning political will. And it is helpful to have a disaster now and then, particularly one that affects New York City, because every frickin' media outlet in the country is suddenly threatened and it's an important issue. But there is fear out there about that waning political will. Manifest in, oh, we're going to focus on New York City and Chicago, but hey, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma, not so much. There's also a bit of shame in this group because they understood that when the money was flowing, they took a very parochial view about it, not infrequently, and bought all the toys for boys that they could get their hands on for their local jurisdiction, not thinking necessarily about a substate or an intrastate set of realities. They did what people do, but they understood how that left them with a narrower capability more globally than what they might otherwise have had. So they were motivated to look for a better solution. Their pride was there, and they were ready to grow. So we see a set of recommendations, but it will take leadership within the federal sector, within the state sector, to facilitate it. Facilitate it. Not direct it, necessarily. Oh, you can pound on your chest. And, I direct it. I'm the leader here, and this is the way it's going to be. That ain't going to work very well. They commented on that. They want standards, but they don't want somebody telling them this is going to be your standard. So facilitation of the discussion around the problem becomes important, and the information flow about useful best practices will lead to embrace of standards from a bottom-up perspective where the feds have facilitated the knowledge. It was an interesting experience. It's what I did for 3 years, in my view, well, almost 30 years, because I spent a ton of time on the road with tribes when I was with Indian Health Service, because those were the people I served out there, not here in Washington necessarily. So leadership is the call. And on the federal side, the talk is good, the PDD is not bad, but where's the leadership that facilitates this and operationalizes it, as Paula said, is the real challenge. And if our younger leaders in those organizations are given their opportunity, they will do it. There are a couple of folks in here that were some of the younger leaders that I think were important. So I'm optimistic. I always am. I'm a half-full kind of guy. Otherwise, I wouldn't have survived the many years of disaster response. And, of course, I grew up on the res. And if you grow up on the res, it's a 9/11 every frickin' day. And you either learn to survive and find a way to move forward, or you drink yourself to death. It's unfortunate, but there it is. So let's lead, people. Let's find a way to facilitate the capacity and the leadership that is there waiting to be developed in those environments.
We have 15 minutes, and we'd like to open it up to, first of all, questions, but more importantly, discussion. You all have your own perspectives and ideas, and even some anecdotal things. And I'd like to start that ball off by asking Bill to come back up again. And Bill didn't address this in his remarks, but he was very much involved in the last 2 weeks and the effort up there. And I want you to bring it a little bit back to home here on what we're talking about and your experience up in Connecticut.
Okay, let me first tell you that, as I mentioned in my comments, there'll be people who analyze this and figure out what was done right, wrong. But I can tell you that it was pleasant to see a couple of things happen. It was very encouraging that if you begin to think about this for a second, and I know many of us weren't paying attention to this, but there were a few that had to be paying attention to it, really about 10 days before anybody even really heard of Hurricane Sandy, we were picking up NOAA weather radar, all the transatlantic movement of that storm. And, you know, there were a few very courageous weather people who were already going out on a limb and say, you know, if all this stuff lines up right and the moon comes up in the right place, this thing's going to come right across New York City. So, you know, as odd as it might have sounded, I mean, this storm was so far away, it hadn't even got to the Caribbean yet, and they were saying it's going to go in a certain place. So, and then, you know, a few days later, we started watching, and we're paying attention to some cold front that's coming across as normal, coming across from the west. So, you know, who was thinking about 3 feet of snow in Kaiser, West Virginia at that point? So my point is that every time we see one of these situations, it's really heartwarming to see, for example, as an emergency responder, that the weather is getting better. Weather is so important in so many areas. Last year, for example, in Texas, when we had the horrific fires, I participated in the fires out some ungodly places out in the western part of Texas. And, you know, the most critical thing that happened every day was the weather briefing about what was going to happen in that process. So, you know, it just, in our business, it gives you a whole new appreciation for development, satellite technology, and everything else that tells us that. Another thing that has become very obvious, for example, is that we have talked for quite a long time. I do a television show and a radio show, but especially on the radio show, we talk a lot about individual preparedness, citizen preparedness, and everything else, because we all know this starts with each one of us in this room being prepared better than we are. And, you know, the amazing thing was that throughout the state of Connecticut, even in the lower four counties, and I hesitate to use the word counties because we're one of those states that don't recognize counties, but, you know, on the map we show four counties along the coast, Long Island Sound. And that is, they were just devastated, especially from like where the Connecticut River dumps into the Sound around Old Saybrook, all the way west right into New York City, as you know. I mean, it was some pretty horrific damage. Now, let me qualify that by saying I'm not suggesting at all that it was similar to what was going on in Staten Island and and a few and the New Jersey coast. But for us, it was pretty significant. So my point here is that there was a lot of resiliency that was displayed both upstate and downstate from the standpoint of people had evidently been paying attention. We only had the governor on television twice, literally telling senior executives in these towns, you need to start the evacuation. If there was one thing that we still, in Connecticut, still dealt with, it was the fact that it was pretty obvious to everybody in the world that the size and magnitude, this thing is like the second biggest storm we've ever had, that just the bleed-over effect is going to do devastation to many of our low-lying areas. And getting some city managers and mayors to understand it's time to start moving people out. You know, they have a tendency not to realize that North Carolina's not as far away as you think, and it'll be here in about 12 hours. So, you know, the weather, the resiliency of the people that were involved, the response capability, as I alluded to, the response capability of a lot of the state organizations, CERT teams, which people thought five, six years ago, people thought that was a joke. In our state, they have become an integral part of the disaster recovery operations and the disaster response operations. As a statewide chairman, I get calls about once a week on how do we get one of those things. You know, they now are finally waking up. About half of the municipalities in the state of Connecticut have a functioning community emergency response team. So, you know, just from this storm, we have seen stand-up capability that once again didn't exist in Katrina, but is now starting to play a vital role in that built-in protection service that we have. And so those factors alone really made us all feel much better in the process. And this was the first disaster that the state of Connecticut has had where they actually recognized regionalization and tried to funnel resource response through the regions as a part of another step. Because we are one of those states that generally just do state, local, forget everything else in between. So that's some of the key factors that we saw from that standpoint.
Well, thank you, Bill.
Okay.
I'd like to introduce the newest member of the Dom Prep 40, Dane Egley. Dane is from Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, and he just completed a book on resilience. And I'd like for you to share some of your experience, what your book talks about that we did not address here today and where we have overlap. So.
Thank you very much, Marty. Well, I would say I just spent 2 days up Rockaway to Long Beach on the Barrier Islands, so that is an eye-opener. It underscores that we're on. These are the right topics. I met with Rick Larrabee, who's been the Director of Commerce at Port Authority, New Jersey, New York, for the past 10 years. So here's what I saw, which also reinforced the findings in our book, in the book called Beyond the Storms. And the reason we called it Beyond the Storms is Katrina's occurred, 9/11 occurred, Sandy, and we are very good at reacting because we're all former first responders. And so we've reacted, we've gotten these lessons learned, which really turn out to be more lessons observed. And we do need a framework. We do need a new way of thinking about this. And we do have PPD 8, which talks about whole of nation in theory. It has all the right words. So how do we operationalize it? Well, we do need something that we can go into Rockaway, we can go into Port Authority, New York, and we can deal with a pandemic in a standardized way. So the first thing is a framework, and we offer some thoughts on that. By no means a panacea, but to shift this idea from prevent, protect, which we have exhausted the nation, we have spent our funds on something we cannot buy our way out of, we cannot protect ourselves out of. Guns, gates, guards, dogs, locks will not get us there. We have to move systemically to the right to mitigate, respond, and recover. And there are some discrete things we can do, learning from the Brits, from the Israelis, that we just haven't done. We are not a culture of preparedness. These foreigners look at us when the lights go out and go, you haven't even begun to imbue to your culture the kind of things you need to do at the private citizen level. So back to my visit last week with Craig Fugate, Rich Serrano, Dave Kaufman, and their team, FEMA is doing some amazing things. They're doing some things that haven't been done before. They have three working groups, for example, social media, community engagement, and strategic solutions. And they're pulling in people from all over the community of interest. It's completely consistent with the report. It's very consistent with the book that I just wrote. But here's what's sobering. As good as we are at holding meetings, codifying these things, we still have 20 power trucks that come up from Georgia that get turned around and sent back because they're non-union. We still have 15 fuel trucks that come up from Pennsylvania that get turned back because they have not paid the tariff fees. We still have volunteers that get turned around because they didn't follow the right traffic pattern. It's primitive. It's very simple. But I guess my last comment would be Rick Larrabee, Director of Commerce for Port Authority in New Jersey and New York, said, this storm, Sandy, made 9/11 look easy. Said, excuse me? 9/11 was a discrete hit at a specific location with a bounded set of solutions. Implications across the country, yes. But this has a regional feel. It has cascading effects because of the interdependencies, not just in the U.S., but all over the world. So if you flood, if you take 4 feet of salt water into the subway, or if you take a tidal surge of 14 feet at the Battery, they begin to witness things they weren't prepared for. They took the National Weather Service brief. They got all the predictors, but they didn't have the experience, the vision, the capacity to think through the things up front, and they were the first ones to admit that. So I think that we've identified the important areas. We have 90 findings, 20 recommendations in our report. Marty showed me the report as I was putting my book together, and they do line up well. I do agree with you on leadership, but I think it's going to have to be visionary leadership. It's going to have to be empowered leadership. It's going to have to be political leadership. And so I think that there's no one silver bullet, and I think today I would even say that as I listened to Admiral Allen, that we're going to have to find a way to integrate what we've said. Because if you look at infrastructure, there is no, we've got a lot of national policy, but there is really no national infrastructure. It's local, state, and regional, and then maybe continental. So lots of conferences going on and lots of people talking about it. We're going to have to operationalize it in a way that thinks about this differently than we have. So I commend the report. I really enjoyed going through it, and I just happened to be working on the same thing at this time. So I have this effort that's called Beyond the Storms. If you'd like me to send it to you, I can send it electronically. It's interesting, the bloggers. This is a group I didn't think about. There is a cadre of really smart people out there that I didn't know about until I put in writing. But the bloggers are out there. They're fired up. They're hungry. And they got a lot of good ideas, much of which parallels what we've come up with here.